It's often said that children are our most important resource, our future, the place we go to see how thoughtful and caring we are as a people and a nation. Does our 20th century history justify such a statement? How successful have we been in creating public policies that really have improved the well-being of our children? To discuss these issues, we have with us Judith Seelander, the author of a new book, The Failed Century of the Child, Governing America's Young in the 20th Century, published recently by Cambridge University Press. We're speaking with Judith Seelander from the campus of Bowling Green State University, where she is a professor of history. Welcome, Judy Seelander.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Let's begin with the title of your book, The Failed Century of the Child. We can assume there's an important argument in that title. What is it?
Americans celebrate the individual. They celebrate family. They admire dedication to citizenship. But they rarely acknowledge that support for these three praiseworthy values often poses inherent conflicts. And like Americans, American governments rarely establish clear priorities when the interests of the young, their elders, or the general public do clash.
Is it harder to establish priorities because of children?
Well, what I argue in the book is that failure to make these kinds of priorities help produce what I labeled the failed century of the child. And that itself is a reference to a book published in 1900. Nice for me, just as the 20th century began. It was a bestseller the first year of the 20th century. Swedish author Ellen Key predicted that during the next 100 years, children's welfare would center social progress, that this would be the century of the child. Nowhere did this happen, certainly not the United States. It's worth noting, too, Jim, that failure is a word that demands a frame, and that frame is the goals, which were ambitious ones.
Too ambitious in the end?
Too ambitious in some ways, but worth praise in some aspects.
Let's get a little more precise here and talk about a particular area. You focus on four areas: child welfare, work, education, health. Let's dig in with health, with children's health. It looks on the surface at the beginning of the century, in 1900, very high infant mortality rates, for example. But by the end of the century, very low children's mortality rates. What's the problem?
Much had changed for the good in children's health. Immunization programs that all states required were a significant victory for children. But in some ways, they were victims of their own success. By the late 20th century, only Americans born before 1955 could vividly remember being frightened of polio or diphtheria or other infectious diseases. Very few people that age were taking their babies and toddlers in for vaccinations. And vaccinations became blamed for a wide variety of problems that pediatricians said were not to be placed at their doors. In terms of diet, in the early 20th century, the malnourished kid was too skinny. Very significant numbers of potential draftees washed out as late as World War II because they couldn't meet the Army weight minimum.
What is that? It's something like one in three during World War
II? Yeah. That and bad teeth, which could also plausibly be chalked up to just not getting sufficient amounts of food. So a nation where significant numbers of kids just were eating too little became, by the end of the 20th century, a country where very significant numbers were eating too much, but probably of the wrong foods, though debate about what was the right food was endless.
Well, what does government have to do with that? And you write a lot about government and the challenges of setting priorities in terms of public policy. Is government responsible for obesity in children by the end of the century?
No, by no means. But I think that the kinds of guidelines provided by government managed to keep the idea of nutrition in at least the back reaches of people's minds, but also managed to hopelessly confuse.
What about exercise, physical education in schools? Did they not bring progress?
There's a chapter in the book titled Shaped Up by the State. The reference there is to the fact that the phrase shaped up was a slang phrase that entered the language in the late 19th century. It meant fattening up cows for slaughter. By the 1990s, mandatory PE programs typically required fewer than 12 hours exercise per year. hardly overwhelming, especially when students in many school districts spent that time at pep rallies.
So they really weren't exercising, they really weren't sweating, they really weren't doing what exercise is supposed to do.
Exercise has become something everyone says they should do, but often fails to do. The greatest predictor for a lean and fit kid is a lean and fit parent, and they are in short supply as well. The 20-somethings making the gym industry big business are not the parents struggling to combine work, home life, housework. The parents are pooped and the kids haven't shaped up.
Let's go back to the question of priorities, and I'd like to read a short sentence from the beginning of your book. You write, "The country's elderly, not its children, most benefited as the recipients of federally sponsored programs of retirement stipends and medical care." Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's one of the major themes in the book. We haven't yet, in any developed world, certainly not here, yet figured out how to cope with the dramatic growth of the old, over 65, and the old. Age formed one pillar, I argue, of the 20th century U.S. welfare state's promises, and paid employment, a job, or connection to somebody with a job. If you're the wife of an employed person, even if you don't work, age is one pillar, a job's another, and children don't have either. Laws, much more importantly than laws, a changed economy marginalized child labor in the 20th century, and the old voted. Children didn't. Buoyed by federal aid for retirement and health, as well as other factors, the percentage of poor Americans over age 65 dropped, just as the percentage of those over age 65 in the population soared as we began to live a lot longer. In the last half of the century, the percentage of poor Americans under age 18, however, remained stubbornly static, about 1 in 5.
So we've increased support for the elderly without changing the possibilities for the young. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Is there a turning point, or is this just a gradual sort of situation over the 20th century?
Well, the turning point is the 1930s, when the elderly begin to organize into what emerges as one of America's most potent political lobbies. And we define age in important ways for the first time with the Social Security Act, which, of course, expected most people to be dead by age 65, not living for another 20 years on government benefits.
But the 1930s is also the time of the CCC, the Civilian
Yes.
Conservation Corps.
Yes, the CCC was one of the great successes in a failed century. It took over 3 million despairing, out-of-work adolescents, taught them job skills, gave them a new position, that they are the ones, because they send most of the money home, supporting their families. It may have had huge compound benefits. They're one of the poorest groups. Anyone in the CCC had to be on the relief rolls, had to come from a really desperate family. And even in a time of prosperity, when in the 50s and 60s the economy boomed, former CCCers who came from the most impoverished sections of the country did better than average.
Is there any other program like the CCC that has worked, or are the other programs of comparable sort failures?
Well, I think that there are all kinds of programs, if you take the frame of goals, that worked. There's no developed nation that tried as hard to educate everybody, not certain groups with certain skills, everybody. That's amazing. And when you consider that goal and the amount of money that was spent early in the 20th century, American education doesn't need to beat up on itself as often happens, even though there are significant shortcomings in the American public schools.
That's a very interesting statement, Judy. Can you elaborate? Can you give us an example to support that argument?
there's no Western European country that provided the kind of not only free but required public education system that existed everywhere, even in the rural South by the 1940s. And those who talk about America being far behind, say, European countries in benefits to citizens in public spending, should remember that a lot takes place at the local and state levels, even county levels. That's where the spending is in the early 20th century, and we undertake an obligation to educate that other countries do not do to the same degree. If you try to do that kind of experiment, it'll be difficult to achieve it. It's a reflection of the enormity of the ambition.
I think that's relevant to the last question I really wanted to ask, and that is that in the end you give two cheers for the 20th century's achievements in creating good public policies for children. Why two cheers? Why not three, or why not zero? No cheers.
Well, I'm sure as many listeners already realize, this is a reference to novelist E.M. Forster's Two Cheers. Forster awarded societies that tried to protect the powerless two cheers, even when they didn't do so very well. And I would argue that 20th century American governments, and I emphasize the S because of the federal nature, it's national, state, and local, 20th century American governments reached out to children that other centuries enslaved or ignored. And our failures to create what we were just talking about, truly model public school curriculums or entirely effective punishment systems for teenage criminals, our failure to abolish child abuse, reflect the difficulties inherent in those tasks.
Are we too impatient sometimes?
No question.
Thank you very much, Judith C. Lander. Judith C. Lander is the author of a new book, The Failed Century of the Child, Governing America's Young in the 20th Century.